fingers pulled apart around the knife handle, and the blade clattered to the floor. Lazmet stood, faced me, and picked it up, examining the handle.
"Not a finely made knife," Lazmet said.
"It would have done the job," I said.
"Any fool with a hammer can smash in a skull, little daughter," he said.
I had forgotten how tall he was. Though I stood taller than most women, he still towered over me, as Rizek had. And with his pale skin tinted green by the light through the jars of preservative, he looked like a rotting corpse.
"I thought you more refined, based on upbringing alone."
"My access was limited," I said. "Trust me, I would have wrapped my mother's blade in silk and crammed it in your eye socket if I had had unlimited resources." He released me halfway, so my arm fell to my side, and my posture straightened. I regained the use of my eyes, so I could blink and look at Akos, who sat motionless at his place at the table. He had only been here for 2 weeks, if the information we had gotten from R.A. was correct. But he had changed. He had always been lean, but his face was now gaunt, and if he had stood, I was sure the slight paunch that had made his waist soft was now gone. The bones in his wrist stood out like little rocks under the skin. He was paler than pale, as green in this light as my father was, and unkempt, like he had not bothered to bathe in several days. I ached with hunger, with sympathy, and yes, with longing, even still, as I looked at him. Knowing that he hadn't abandoned me just to return home and wait out the war had made it more difficult to be angry with him. Coming here had been stupid, but it had at least been for a greater purpose. I stared at him, trying to get some kind of acknowledgement that I was standing right in front of him, and he stared back, but without recognition. He almost looked the way Aijah had, after Rizek had traded his first memory with him, like he didn't know who I was or where he was. Like someone had broken him and put him back together incorrectly.
"There is a saying from a Shotet cleric that seems apt, given the situation," Lazmet said.
He spun the knife on his palm and caught it by the blade, offering it back to me, handle first. I gritted my teeth as the wriggling in my brain began again, and my hand extended, my fingers closing around the handle.
"Only use a blade if you're prepared to die by it."
I shuddered hard as I realized what he was about to do. I fought the thing in my brain with every ounce of my strength as my hands both clasped the handle, turning the blade to face my own stomach. He had left my mouth free so that he could hear me scream. I was sure of it.
"Akos!" I yelled. "Touch him!"
"My son's current gift is not active at the moment," Lazmet said. "But he is, of course, welcome to try."
Akos had not moved. I watched as he swallowed, hard, and fixed his gaze on me.
"No," he said quietly. "There's no point."
My hands pulled closer, and the tip of the blade touched my stomach. And somehow I had always known this was how death would find me, at the hands of my own family, and at the end of my own knife. But though this felt familiar, and even expected, I refused to accept it. It hadn't occurred to me until then that though Lazmet controlled my muscles, he didn't necessarily control my current gift. And while I couldn't control it that well either, I knew that it was hungry to be shared,
As ever, it wanted to devour everything in its path, even if what was in its path was me. The doctor my mother had taken me to when I was young had told me my current gift was an expression of what I thought I deserved, and what I thought other people deserved. Pain. Perhaps there was truth in that. Perhaps I was now learning that I didn't deserve it as much as I had once thought. But regardless, I did know one thing. There was no other man in the galaxy who had earned pain more than the one who stood in front of me. I didn't send out a hesitant tendril, wondering if it would work. I threw my current gift at Lazmet Noavek with all the force of my will, and a black cloud engulfed him like a swarm of insects. He screamed, without control, without the luxury of pride. The knife stopped moving toward my gut, but I couldn't release it either. Then I heard a sharp pop as one of the jars on the shelves that lined the walls burst like a balloon, its contents spurting over the floor. Another one shattered right after it, and another. Soon the air was pungent with the smell of long-preserved flesh, and the light was changing from greenish to white. The floor was slick, and white lumps rolled this way and that. The wriggling in my brain subsided, and hands grabbed my shoulders from behind, dragging me backward. I screamed, "No!" I had been so close to killing him. But the hands pulled me into the hidden hallway behind me, and once I was in the dark, I knew better than to try to run back. Instead, I threw myself forward, spotting the bobbing of a knot of hair that told me it was Etrek who had grabbed me. We ran, my father's shouting chasing us into the shadows. I jumped down half a flight of stairs I knew was coming, and turned a sharp corner, only to find Ima Zetsivas standing at the exit in the kitchen, her blue eyes wild. "Come quickly," she said, and together we ran to the back gate, where Tekka was waiting, motioning us out. Running through the streets around Noavek Manor reminded me of the Sojourn Festival. My hand wrapped around Akosis, my face itching from blue paint. Chasing him with water cupped in my hands, though it was raining down from above. And the quiet of afterward, when I stripped my blue-stained clothes in my bathroom, and realized there was something calm and still inside me that hadn't been that way since before my mother died. Since he had kissed me in the transport vessel galley, I had thought about what the exact moment was that I fell for him. Now, dragging air into struggling lungs as I ducked around corners and under low ceilings in the tunnels of Noavek Manor, I wondered whether I had fallen for him while he was lying to me, making a show of being kind so that I would reveal how to get out of the manor. And if it had been during that time, did that mean I loved someone who didn't exist? A pretend Akos, like one of the storyteller's smoke pictures? A group of people running would have attracted more attention than anything, so when we were a few streets away from Noavek Manor, I put my hood up and slowed to a walk. Ima, too, tucked her blonde hair under a black scarf, though the pale color of her gown, lavender today, still made her wealth too obvious. We would have to address that before we reached the fringes of the city. Tekka hooked her elbow around mine, making sure my skin was covered as well as hers. But it was instinct to draw my current shadows away from her, focusing them on the left side of my body instead of the right. Facing down my father had reminded me what the control felt like. Not like controlling the shadows themselves, more like plating my body with armor so they couldn't touch me, and letting them flow elsewhere. "This way we're just a pair of friends walking back from the market together," she said, tipping her head toward me. "No one expects Syra Noavek to have a friend." Sometimes she still said things that wounded me. and not because they were lies. We walked that way, a dozen paces behind Etrek and Zeet, and half a dozen paces in front of Ema. "You'd be better off walking with her," I said, tipping my head back slightly. "You two could be mother and daughter." Tekka just shrugged. When the streets turned from stone to broken stone to dirt, we stopped to address Ema's clothing. Tekka loaned her a cloak with a hood, and she tied the dark scarf around her waist to cover most of her skirt. Only a little lavender peeked out from the bottom when she was in motion. Still, we made our way quickly to the safe house, with at least one of us peering over a shoulder every few steps, as if that wasn't suspicious on its own. When we were tucked away inside the huge space, Etrek turned to me.
"You know, it took a lot out of me, breaking all those jars," he said. "The least you could do is not look so angry at being rescued."
Now that we were safe, I let myself break. This time, I fell apart shouting.
"I had him! I was on the verge of killing him! And you decided to rescue me?"
Sifa emerged from a stairwell, her hands clasped in front of her. Had she known that we would fail? I didn't even want to consider the idea.
"Killing him!"
Etrek's hair was dusted with dirt, like sugar on top of a cake.
"You were about to plunge a current blade in your own stomach!
These current shadows aren't only good for making me flinch a lot, you know!"
I charged toward him, crushing a patch of fragile flowers under the heel of my shoe.
"I had him wrapped in them. I would have killed him."
"Maybe not before he killed you," Etrek said quietly.
"And?"
I demanded. He retreated, his back colliding with Zeet's chest, and I said,
"When someone asks you to trade the chance of Lazmet Noavek's death for the life of Rizek's scourge," and then shouted, "You do it!"
The echo in the half-exploded space lasted a long time. "You and the Karaseth boy both exasperate me," Ema said, undoing the clasp on the cloak she had borrowed and lowering the hood. "So eager to throw your lives away."
"It's not just his life he's willing to throw away," I snapped. "It's mine, too."
"Yes, that was quite a shock, him not saving you," Ema said. "I wasn't sure he had the fortitude. I was so concerned I thought about creating it in him, but I was afraid of the damage I might do in the process."
"Creating it?" I said.
"Yes," she said. "The reason your family has kept me alive so long is that I twist hearts into the shapes of my choosing."
"That," I said, "explains a lot."
"Does it?" Ema's tone was wry. "In any case, you are remarkably consistent, Miss Noavek. The boy has been starved, imprisoned, beaten, manipulated, threatened, and shown his friend's eyeballs in a jar at dinner, and still you think about what he allowed to happen to you."
"Ema," Tekka said, looking sick.
"No, no, let her get it out." I held my arms wide. "Which am I, then? Irritatingly self-sacrificial or shockingly self-centered? Do I have to choose?"
She raised her eyebrows, which were so pale they almost blended into her skin.
"You would die so that we all have to honor you. You are too big-headed for the slow fade into obscurity, also known as a regular life. One thing I will say for your former paramour is that, unlike you, he has no thirst for glory, at least." I was about to respond when I noticed that Tekka had covered her face. I heard a sharp sound, muffled by her palms. A sob.
"Jorik," she said.
It pulled the anger out of me, like sucking the poison from a bite. I had forgotten. Ema had forgotten, too, or she might not have chosen such specific words. Shown his friend's eyeballs in a jar. Not only was Jorek gone, but he had suffered the same horror as Tekka beforehand. It was not the way anyone should have to die. Ema went to her in the way that only family could, wrapping her arms around her niece and clutching her close. I stood nearby, not willing to leave, but unsure how to stay. In more ways than one. Sifa had walked over. Her hair was tucked into a bumpy braid, the same wavy, thick, smooth texture as my own. Did you know? I said. I could have been asking about a dozen things, but I didn't bother to clarify.
I suspected. I am still not sure exactly what's coming, or how to steer us. The situation has become exponentially more complicated.
My chin wobbled when I spoke next. If you don't know how to steer us, why did you come?
You won't like my answer. As if that had ever mattered.
Sifa lifted a shoulder.
I came to be with you.
Sifa, the woman who had abandoned her husband and children to the horror of murder and kidnapping. The woman who had coaxed her son into killing Vas Kuzar and allowed Orieva Benazit to die in the name of fate, had come here not to maneuver, but just to be with me? I wasn't sure whether to believe her or not, so I just nodded, sharply, and walked away. The slant of light coming through the broken ceiling had taken on a burnt color, like still cooling embers. That meant the day was done, with no plan, no path, no way back to Lazmet Noavek. Morning would come, and the time Issei Benazit had given us would run out.
Chapter 48 Sizi. I wake with a sour taste in my mouth. I am not sure where I am. The last time I knew anything, I was in my bathroom with blood soaking my side, and Ast had just stabbed me. I thought I would die. But wherever I am, I don't seem to be dead. My tongue feels like it's fuzzy. I cringe a little at the feeling. Someone sticks a straw between my lips, and I drink. Water fills my mouth, and I swish it around before swallowing. And, oh, swallowing hurts. Not my throat, but my stomach. It's like someone tore right through my abdomen. I open my eyes. I'm not sure why I expect to see the big crack that's above my bed at home. When I was sick as a kid, I used to think about what it was shaped like. A floater? A bird? I could never decide. There's no crack in this ceiling, though. The ceiling here is a moving image, like the ones in the walls at assembly headquarters. It shows a blue sky with puffy clouds drifting across it. I lift a hand. There's a patch of tech just under my knuckles. I can feel it, stinging a little as I wiggle my fingers. It's probably monitoring my vitals, heart rate and temperature and blood sugar. There's a little exit point on top of it, attached now to a tube with clear liquid running through it. Keeping me hydrated, I assume, though it's not doing anything for the taste in my mouth. Miss Kariseth? I blink away the film covering my eyes and see a woman dressed in a crisp white uniform, shirt and pants, with a dark blue apron over the top of it. Her hair is tied back and secured with pins. She wears rubber gloves. I feel unmoored. In my mind, I list the things I know. I am not at home. Judging by the ceiling, I am in a rich place. Assembly headquarters? No. Ophir. Ophir is where we were last. I'm hurt. My stomach. It's like someone tore right through my abdomen. I remember his face in the mirror, right next to mine. Someone did just that. Ast, I croak. What? The nurse frowns. He's not here right now. He came yesterday to check on you, though. He came to check on me? No, he came to make sure I was still unconscious, or in the hope that I was dead. A shiver runs through me. He was here while I was unconscious. What if he did something else? What if he tried to finish what he started? I imagine a pillow pressed to my mouth, a vial of poison tipped down my throat, stitches pulled from the wound in my abdomen until my guts spill out. No, I say, and it comes out a growl. No. Ast did it. Ast stabbed me. Miss Karaseth, I think you're confused. You've been out for a couple days. I am not. The security footage of your room was missing, she says softly. Of course it was, I think, but can't say. Ast found a way to delete the evidence. But they found the weapon, wiped of fingerprints, she continues, in the house of a man whose current gift allows him to put on different faces. The Ophirian police suspect he was trying to kill the Chancellor and got you instead. I squeeze my eyes shut. Of course. Ast plays at being too simple for politics. He senses current gifts. He grew up with real-world smarts and contacts with seedy reputations, no doubt. Of course he knew how to cover his tracks. He deleted the footage, misled the police, found a likely suspect to frame for the crime, planted the weapon. But why? Why would he take this risk? Just to be right? To get his way? Why did he even care so much about what happened to Thuva in this war? It was him, I say with some difficulty. Maybe, I think as I drift off again. It's not Thuva he cares about, but Chotet. Issei told me the story once, of how she got the scars. I never asked her, because that wasn't the sort of thing you just asked about, but she told me anyway. We had been sitting on the old, grungy sofa in my school apartment. There were pots brewing on burners everywhere, so the corners of the room were full of vapor. We were in Shissa, so through the floor-to-ceiling windows on the far wall, all I could see were snowdrifts far below. My room was hardly even wide enough for me to stretch out my arms in both directions, but it had a good view. She had an embroidered pillow in her lap, one I had bought from a little shop in Hesse, where a friend from primary school worked. She was wearing socks I had loaned her because hers weren't warm enough. They were yellowish-brown, or brownish-yellow, I could never decide which, and had a lumpy heel where I'd gone wrong with mending them. She told me that she hadn't really grown up on a pirate ship. That was just what she told people, to startle them. The transporter ship she was on as a kid did some shady business every now and then, she said, but nothing to get huffy about. And trust me, she said, if there was something to get huffy about, my parents would be huffy. They had landed on Isander to dump the goods from their most recent job, and it just happened to be the planet where the Chotet were doing their seasonal scavenge. Only scavenges weren't supposed to include theft and murder, according to the ethical guidelines Chotet had agreed to when the assembly was formed. The Chotette boarded the transporter ship, much like pirates would have done, and they blew through the vessel room by room, rifling through everything to find valuables and killing whoever they wanted. One of the scavengers threatened Issei's mother, and when her father defended her, they both wound up dead. So Issei went at the man with a meat mallet. "A meat mallet?" I asked her, so shocked I couldn't help but smile. It was all right. She smiled too. She cracked one of them hard in the head, she said, but meat mallets are worthless against a Chotette soldier. Actually, pretty much anything was, according to her. They were lethal. And the leader of the group, a woman, must have admired Issei's gumption, because instead of killing her, she pinned Issei down and carved into her face, saying, "Remember me." She hadn't mentioned Ast at the time, except to say that some of her friends were hurt or killed, too. Now, though, I knew that he had been there, and that a Chotette soldier had killed his father and half of his friends. Yeah, there were plenty of reasons for Ast to care what happened to Chotette in this war. "See?" Issei's voice sounds strained. She looks worn, her hair lank around her face. She grabs my hand and squeezes it. I guess Ast must not have told her I tried to send a message to the Chotette exiles then, or she would have me arrested instead of sitting at my bedside. "Did you?" My voice sounds creaky as an old door. "Did you make the alliance with Othir?" "You don't need to worry about that right now," she says. "Just focus on healing, okay? We almost lost you. I almost lost you." "I'm fine," I say. I tap the button to raise the top half of the bed. When I'm partially upright, pain burns all the way through to my back, but I don't want to lie down again. "Tell me." "Yes, I made the alliance," she says. "Before you say anything, we needed that weapon, see? The pressure to retaliate is intense." "Pressure from where?" I say. "Ast?" She frowns at me. "Everywhere," she says. "From my own head, for one. From Shisa, Ozak, Hessa. From the assembly leader. Everywhere. They killed innocent people. What am I supposed to do?" "Show mercy," I say, and it's enough to set her off. "Mercy?" she demands. "Mercy. Where was Chotette mercy when they destroyed a hospital? Where was it when that woman held me down and sliced into my face? Where was it for my mother, my father, for Ori?" "Othir gave us an anti-current blast, and I'm going to use it as soon as I can," she says. "At which point I hope you'll tell me your brain was addled by painkillers, because there's no way a right-minded person would call for mercy right now." She storms out with a straight spine. The posture a couple seasons at the assembly taught her, so she would fit in. "They killed innocent people," she said, almost in the same breath she talked about doing the same. And that's the problem, because to her, no Chotette is innocent. And that is the big difference between us. I look up at the clouds projected on my ceiling. They're thicker now, closer together. I'm stuck here, and out of options. Out of time. I dream of the Oracle Vara, showing me the sculptures in the Hall of Prophecy on Agra. Each one is a member of my family, made of glass. Even Syra is among them. And I wake to Ast's face, looming over mine. "I'm not here to hurt you," he says when the beetle chirps, signaling to him I'm sure that I've moved. "Issei will be along soon. I just wanted to have a chat with you first." He drags the stool over to my bedside and sits, the beetle perching on his shoulder. You may have noticed that I didn't tell Issei that you tried to contact our enemies. That you tried to contact Syra Noavec. My face is hot. My throat burns. I want to speak, to yell, to wrap my hands around his throat.
I didn't think it was wise to arouse her suspicions. You betray her and in the same night you're attacked?
He says.
But you should know that if I do decide to tell her, I'm sure she will have more sympathy for me than she will for you. Attacking the woman she loves because she turned traitor to her country? It's forgivable. What you did is not.
You. I grit my teeth. The word comes out as a growl, forced as hard as I can past the strictures of my throat and mouth.
So don't step out of line, Cece,
he says.
What's done is done. The attack's been ordered, and I think now we can begin to get along.
I want to scream at the unfairness of it, my silence forced by the current, which supposedly gives all life. If it's such a good thing, why does it strangle me? Why does it torture Syra? Why does it push away my brother and empower dictators and boggle my mother's mind? I hear the sharp, clipped tone of Issei's voice just outside the door. I know then what I need to do. If my gift can't be overcome, then maybe it needs to be put to use instead. I push aside my anger, my grief, my worry. I push aside my pain, too, as much as I can. I remember sinking to the bottom of the pool in the temple basement when I learned to swim. The way the water burned my eyes at first, how it lifted my hair away from my head, made it feel soft, how it caressed and pulsed with its own rhythm, how I could hear my own heartbeat. Issei told me Ast's father went by Wrench. He maintained their little ship. So maybe it's not comfortable things that soften Ast, but hard things. The warm metal handle of a tool his dad just put down. The vibration of the ship's engine in the wall. The prick of a grate under his bare feet. Ast blinks, slowly.
Hey, he says. Stop.
No, I say. He's comfortable enough now that I can talk at least. You've been chastising me for the use of my current gift since you arrived. You watch it strangle me, and you don't do anything to make sure I'm heard. Well, now I'll watch it strangle you.
You're controlling her, Ast says. I can't let you.
The rough sleeve of a maintenance worker's coveralls. Faintly frayed. Engine oil rubbed between two fingers. Smooth and faintly sticky. A screw catching in place and tightening. Turn after turn. You try to get your way, and I try to get mine, I say. But neither of us controls her.
No, you're...
He leans back and closes his eyes.
It's different.
You're right. My methods are far more effective, I say softly. You think I use my gift recklessly. You have no idea how much I hold back. I hit him with it again. The shudder of the seat beneath him as his ship passes through an atmosphere. The crinkle of the wrapper that comes around a prepackaged protein cake at a fuel station. I wrap the textures around him, metal and plastic and vapor and grease, until he may as well be living back in that ship. He sags against the wall and just stares at me. You will not get in my way anymore, I say. I will guide us away from catastrophe, and you will allow me to. The door opens, admitting Issei, dressed in her training clothes. Her face shines with sweat. She smiles at Ast and me, likely thinking we're making peace. As if peace is what I could have with someone who attacks me, and threatens me, and takes advantage of my inability to speak. "What's wrong?" she says, her face falling as she takes in the scene. Me, tense and upright, hands clenched into fists. Ast sagging, shoulders curled in, eyelids half closed. "Tell her," I say to him. "Tell her what you did to me." He stares, his eyes empty. "Tell her," I say slowly.
"I attacked you,"
he says to me. Then to Issei.
"It was me. I attacked her."
"You... what?" Issei says. "Why?"
"She was interfering,"
he says. I can't sustain this level of energy for much longer. I pull back on my current gift with a gasp. When Ast returns to himself, his face crumples into rage. Issei looks stricken. "I'm sorry. I pretend to choke on the words. I let myself falter and grab my stomach with one arm, wincing. Let her see me as weak, out of control. "I didn't mean to," I say, "but I needed you to believe me."
"She's lying to you," Ast snaps. "Can't you see that? She's using her current gift to manipulate you, to control you. She's been doing it this whole time."
"Look. Look at his arm," I say. "There's a bite mark from where I fought back." Issei's jaw tightens. She marches over to him and grabs his arm, pulling him to his feet. He goes where she directs him, maybe knowing that he can't fight a chancellor, or that I've finally beat him. She pushes up his sleeve, and there it is. A perfect impression of my teeth, an uneven half-circle. She drops his arm with a soft moan.
She was trying to contact the Shotet, he says. She tried to send a message to...
Shut up, Issei says. She blinks rapidly. I trusted you. You lied to me. You... I want you arrested. I want you gone. I am slipping away. Too tired to stay. But before I go, I look at Ast. And though I know he can't see it, I smile.
Chapter 49, Akos. Akos was staring into the fire when the door opened the next morning. He had expected, when Syra fled without his help, to break down completely. Instead, he felt like all the excess of his life, the agonizing over blood and citizenship and family and fate, had been pared away, like meat cooked away from the bone. And now everything that had been muddled was clear. He was not Thuvizit or Shotet, Karaseth or Noavik, third child or second. He was a weapon against Lazmet Noavik. The gnaw of hunger no longer bothered him, except that it left his mind and body fatigued and less useful to him. Ema didn't come to bring him more food, so he knew she had likely helped Syra escape, and he was grateful for that, in a distant way that applied to some other life. In this life, he wanted nothing but to accomplish his goal. "Akos." The voice belonged to Vakrez. Akos rose from his place by the fire, suppressing a shiver at the cold air he found away from it. Vakrez was frowning at him. "Are you all right?" he said more kindly than usual. "I'm fine," Akko said, as he stuck out his arm for Vakrez to take. That's not why I'm here. There wouldn't be much point with Ema gone, Vakrez said. Lazmet summoned me to discuss strategy, and he asked me to collect you on my way. Akos looked for his shoes and found them tucked under the foot of the bed. He stuffed his feet in and raised his eyebrows at the commander when he didn't move away from the doorway. What? He said. You seem... Vakrez frowned. Never mind. They walked side by side to whatever room Lazmet was using for the meeting. His office, it seemed, because they climbed up a staircase with wood-paneled walls instead of going down to the weapons hall. Akos had to stop at the top to catch his breath. And Vakrez waited for him without complaint. His father greeted him with a tilted head when he walked into the office, with its soft rug and its tomes of history stacked high. The peel of the fruit that had clued Lazmet in to Syra's infiltration of the manor sat curled on Lazmet's desk. When Lazmet gestured for Akos to sit, he did this time, at the end of the sofa closest to the fire. He looked down at his fingers. Had his knuckles gotten thicker, or had the rest of his hands simply begun to disappear? His body devouring the last reserves of strength and energy it had. Akos, Vakrez said, jostling his shoulder. Hm? Akos lifted his head. Pay attention, he said, eyebrows raised. He had scolded Akos for inattention more than once. The last time Akos remembered had been at the soldiers' camp, after he had earned his armor, and maybe a small amount of respect from his commander. Vakrez had been lecturing about strategy, something about how the soldier who was on his home ground always had the advantage, because he knew the terrain. Chotet's soldiers therefore had to adapt quickly, as they would never be on their home ground. Even Voa, he said, isn't your home. Chotet have no home. Oh, don't scold him, Vakrez, Lazmet said, leaning back in his chair with a book in his lap. Akos couldn't see the spine. He's not operating at full capacity right now. Why am I here? Akos asked, blinking slowly at Lazmet. I was hoping you would tell me a few things about your hometown, Lazmet said. I understand that you come from Hessa. He was about to ask why Lazmet wanted to know about his hometown. His memories, after all, were the kind a kid would care about, like where the best sweets were, or which shop Aija liked to browse just so he could make eyes at the girl who worked behind the counter. But the answer, when he considered it a little bit more, was obvious. You're going to attack it, Akos said. The thought of Chotet swarming the steep streets of Hessa, charging into the sweet shop, maybe killing the girl who worked behind the counter, made him feel ill. Lazmet didn't answer. It's not hard to figure out, Akos said. He felt far away from everything. There are only three major cities in Thuva. You already hit Shissa, so it's either Orsok or Hessa next. You don't seem troubled, Lazmet said. Do you expect me to believe that you feel nothing for the place where you spent the majority of your life? He wouldn't let himself think about the dim little spice shop that made him sneeze, or the woman who sold elaborate paper flowers in the warm months when it didn't snow. Or the alley that was a straight shot up the hill, the best and most dangerous sledding path in all of Thuva. He wouldn't, or he would get swallowed up in it. Lazmet wanted him to betray his home. Chotet have no home, Akos thought, remembering Vakrez's lecture on strategy. But he did have a home. He had a home ground, a place no one knew as well as he did. "It's not that I feel nothing," he said, steadying himself as much as he could. "It's that I have an offer for you." "Oh?" Lazmet looked amused. Well, that was all right, Akos thought. Better he be amused and underestimate Akos than be suspicious. "You'll take me to Hessa with you, and after your attack is over, you will leave me there, at my house," Akos said. "After that, I won't come after you, and you won't come after me."
"And in return?"
"In return, I'll help you destroy the Temple of Hessa."
Lazmet glanced at Vakres. The commander looked like he was working the idea between his teeth. He sat on the other end of the sofa, somehow managing to make sinking into the cushions look graceful.
"The Temple of Hessa," Lazmet said. "Why should that matter to me?" "Judging by your Shissa attack, you want to be theatrical. Big, destructive gestures are demoralizing, as well as costing a lot of lives," Akos said. "But Hessa doesn't have grand, floating buildings you can knock out of the sky. It has the temple. It's stamped on our old currency from before the assembly was formed. There's nothing else to attack in Hessa except the temple." The odd thing was, he knew that both men already knew this. Lazmet was old enough to remember the siege his mother had led against Hessa, the one that Hessa Temple still bore the busted windows and scraped up stones from. The one Akos's grandmother had gone into with nothing more than a meat cleaver, if the stories were true. So Lazmet probably just wanted to see if Akos would persuade him, or bother to try. More curiosity, more experimentation. It never stopped.
"It's a temple, not a labyrinth," Lazmet said. "I don't really need your help to attack it, now that you've told me that's what I ought to do."
Akos felt the sharp stick of panic in his chest. But he knew Hessa Temple better than most Thuvazits did, and that had to be worth something. It had to.
"By all reports, it may as well be a labyrinth for as much sense as its layout makes. You'd be hard-pressed to find a map of it either," Akos said. "But if you and your fighting force want to run around like a bunch of idiots, giving the Oblates plenty of time to summon the whole army of Hessa, the best army in all of Thuva, I should add, then go right ahead."
"So the layout is nonsensical. There are no maps, and you just happen to know how to navigate it," Lazmet said with a sneer.
"How convenient." "None of this is convenient," Akos said, scowling. "You brought me here because you thought I had something useful to tell you about Hessa, and now I tell you I know something useful and you refuse to believe it."
Akos let out a short laugh.
"I betrayed my country. I got my friend killed. I almost got Syra killed. I have nothing to go back to, nothing left in the world except for that house, where people will leave me alone. You made sure of that, so have your attack, have your war, have whatever you want, but leave me alone, and I'll give you whatever I've got."
Lazmet's eyes were fixed on his, searching, calculating. Akos imagined himself as the armored one, tearing into his own abdomen to make a space for Lazmet to get in. He felt the wire wiggling in his head and the involuntary twitch in his fingers that meant Lazmet was testing him. Suspicious, as always, but Akos had come to expect it.
Lazmet took in his twitching fingers. Akos felt the swoop of something like hope in his gut. And then...
Vakres? Give me a read on him, Lazmet said.
Akos knew it would be more suspicious to object than not, so he stuck out his arm for Vakres to take. It was getting easier and easier to imagine himself as the armored one. The more he wanted to be away from everything and everyone. Armored ones were solitary, separate from everything that channeled the current. Lonely but impenetrable, just like he was. He knew most people who killed them had to find a way to stick a knife in them right under the arm or leg joint, where there was a space between the thick plates that covered its body. They had to get in far enough to make the thing bleed to death. That was how Syra had killed it, he was sure. It was her way. Find the weakness, exploit it, be done with it. It was more honorable than the way he had done it, lulling the beast to sleep, giving it relief, like he was someone to be trusted, and then poisoning it. But that was his way. Except now, there was nothing he could do except let down his current gift shield so that Vakres could poke his way into Akos' heart. And what he would see there was pure intention, the desire to kill Lazmet unmistakable. Vakres touched him, his hand cool and rough as always, and closed his eyes for a few ticks. Akos waited for the blow to fall, waited for the end of him. So much clearer now, Vakres said. He opened his eyes and looked to Lazmet. All he wants is to escape. Akos tried not to stare. It was a lie. Vakres was lying for him. He didn't dare look at the commander. He couldn't afford to give himself away now. Then, my boy, Lazmet said to him, it seems we have a deal. You take me to Hessa, and I'll let you go home. I'll take you to my home ground, Akos thought, and that's where you'll die.
Chapter 50 Syra. The next morning, there was nothing left to do but leave the safe house. Leave Voa, and Lazmet, and Akos. Give up, in other words. We rifled through the drawers of one of the abandoned apartments to find a change of clothes for everyone, then left the safe house. We had promised Issa, who was waiting in the ship for the signal to retrieve us, that we would meet her if we managed to escape. I fidgeted as we walked, the rough fabric of my ill-fitting trousers rubbing at my thighs. Someone's old throw blanket had become a scarf to cover my face, and it, too, chafed. Zeet and Etrek led the way, the knot atop Etrek's head bobbing with each footstep, then Ema and Tekka, at a respectable distance, and Sifa and me, trailing behind. As we passed beneath boarded-up windows, I listened to Ema and Tekka's conversation. I left the house to its ruin, Ema was saying. It's too far away for most thieves to bother breaking into it anyway. Once this is over, I'll help you put it right, Tekka said. That place is full of Uzul anyway, Ema said, shaking her head. She had tucked her hair behind her ears and under the collar of her jacket, so it didn't show as much, but there was no disguising that flawless white. The sound of Uzul's name stung me, though not as much as it stung Ema, I was sure. I had not killed him, not in the way I could have, but pain had driven him to death, and I had provided that pain. Syra Noavec, purveyor of pain, agent of agony. We reached the building where the ship waited,
tucked under its tarp on the roof with Issa inside it. Zeet had sent her a signal the night before, just to tell her at least some of us were alive, so she had not fled the city yet. We trudged up the stairs, which still smelled of garbage, and I found myself beside Zeet again at the head of the group, my long legs giving me an advantage. He cast a soft look at me. Oh, don't. I sighed. I don't do well with sympathy.
Can I offer you a bracing slap on the back? Zeet said. A gruff reassurance, maybe.
Do you have candy? I would take candy. He smiled, reached into his pocket, and took out a piece of bright plastic wrap about the size of a fingertip. I squinted at it, but peeled the wrapper with my fingernail and uncovered a small piece of hard fenzu honey, recognizable due to its bright yellow color. Why, I said, are you carrying candy around in your pocket? Zeet shrugged. He pushed the door to the rooftop open, letting Voa's hazy light into the stairwell. The sky was covered with clouds, and the city had a yellowish cast, a storm brewing. The thick fabric that covered the ship was still tied down, loosely, so Issa could have pulled the ship free easily if she needed to. I ducked under the edge of it, and almost choked on the hard candy. I just stood on the steps that extended from the ship's hatch. What are you doing here? I demanded.
I'm not staying, he warned.
He looked awkward, all his weight on one leg, one hand clasping the hem of his jacket.
That doesn't really answer her question, Tekka said from behind me.
I'm here to warn you all, Ija said.
Why? Did you inform the Shotet police on us again? Zeet said.
No, Ija said. I just wanted to escape. To be free of her.
He nodded to me.
And then some of my visions fell together. Overlapped.
Mine haven't, Sifa said, her brow furrowed.
Issei Benazit imparted some of herself when she forced us, forced Rizek, I mean, to see her memories before he was killed, Ija said. So I have a better grasp on her than you do. I know her from the inside out.
I felt Tekka staring at me, quizzical, but I couldn't look away. Ija's pale green eyes were strange, clearer than they had been in a long time. I know we're out of time, I said. Issei Benazit promised not to pressure Agra to deport the exiles until after my week was up.
Deportation is not what she has in mind now, Ija said. She is preparing another anti-current blast, like the one that destroyed the Sojourn ship.
Sifa lifted a hand to cover her mouth, and for the first time, I knew, not from memory or guesswork, but seeing with my own eyes, that we were the same. The same strong nose, the same fierce brow, the family Karaseth. My family.
Anti-current, I said, redirecting my focus. I was no little girl craving a mother. I had had one. I had killed her. That's what the weapon is called, Ija said. The current is a creative energy, and the anti-current is its opposite. Where the two collide, a strong force results.
I snorted. Strong force, indeed. Issa stepped out of the hatch then, edging around Sifa. She ran toward Etrek, hugging him, then Tekka, and then me, quickly and with wincing, but still a hug.
You lived, she said, breathless.
Speak for yourself, I said. I'm just an apparition.
If that was true, it would likely not hurt to touch you, she said, without a trace of humor. I glanced at Tekka,
who shrugged.
"When is this blast supposed to hit us?" Tekka asked Aija. I gave Aija a hard look.
Concrete